Now, what were you doing back in 1983? Listening to this, no doubt. Big Country. Bass player from Big Country, Tony Butler, my guest this evening. Let's spin back the clock and go back in time. Here's In a Big Country. Now, 1983, when you had been the invincible rhythm machine with Big Country, I think I was working at a hotel in Glasgow. And that just reminds me so much of being in Glasgow now. It's quite a good song for a Glaswegian as well.
Glad it reminds you of something. I can't remember it at all.
Tony, that's got to be almost a quarter of a decade ago now.
It's a long time ago, long time ago. And I haven't heard that track for actually ages. And it's flooded back loads of memories, but... you know, it's just, it sounds a little bit dated, but it still sounds vibrant, I think.
What sort of memories come back to you when you think of the Big Country sort of heyday?
Bruce and Stuart sitting in my front room at my mum's house, building this beer can pyramid while we're writing songs.
That could be any student day, really, couldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was just the thing you did, and, you know, we just... because they were living in Scotland, we couldn't afford to sort of put them up in hotels. They stayed at my mum's house, and we just used to sat up drinking all night and writing songs and playing Sabutio and doing all sorts of silly things.
So it seems then, did Big Country come together quite quickly? Was it something that was formed sort of almost on the hop?
No, basically, I'd been in a band with an old friend and colleague of mine called Simon Townsend, who's a brother of Pete, and Mark Brzezicki, who went on to be the drummer of the band. We'd been in a support band for the Skids, and I kind of met Stuart then. And then after that tour, we sort of said, well, look, we should meet up again sometime. And a year later, I got a call from Stuart's then manager and now my sort of longest-standing friend in the music business, Ian Grant, said, look, you know, can you come and do a session for these guys from Scotland? They're a bit weird, but they make a nice noise. And he said Stuart's name, and I jumped at it.
And how did your life change at that point, then?
Completely, because it was always my intention to be in a band, because myself and Mark, we were basically a rhythm section, just sort of playing to the highest bidders, and, you know, we did some really funny records and stuff. But to be in a band was my ambition, and to sort of come across to insane characters as Stuart Adamson and Bruce Watson was just a dream. And as soon as we started playing together, I just knew that, I don't know, I had no qualification to put behind it, but it just sounded like it was going to be fantastic. And it was.
How was your music accepted in the 80s? I mean, did you have a huge fan group?
We had a huge fan base, but it was quite a distinct demographic. I mean, we were huge in Britain from sort of Watford Gap north. And we were kind of coolly accepted in the South, and it took a few years of the band sort of building up a reputation to sort of become a sort of Southern flavour. But we always felt like that the music industry never really took to Big Country because of its kind of ethnicity. But in terms of popularity, you know, north of England, Europe, America couldn't get enough of the band. And funny enough, and I still can't believe this, even now.
Yeah, because your website is very popular now. The Big Country is still going.
I don't know how. It just keeps going and people still remember it. And Big Country is like a brand name. And, you know, even I walk down the street now and people know the band. I'm not really sure they know its entire repertoire, but, you know, they just know the name and I'm recognized and associated with it. And, you know, I shall always be very proud of that, but it still freaks me out.
Was there still, was back in the 80s, was there that urge to conquer America that there seems to be today?
For us, there was, because we were told that we'd be accepted there, and we went out and toured, and In a Big Country was a top 10 hit in the Billboard chart, and all of a sudden, you know, we were faced with this sort of immenseness, and we should have followed it up and kind of gone the U2 route and did that kind of big Red Rocks kind of thing, but we never got to do that because we concentrated far too much in Europe for some reason, and then the momentum sort of got lost until we sort of did Look Away, and then Look Away was like an MTV hit, which was fabulous for us. And, you know, we had the guy who did all the Pink Floyd album sleeves, a guy called Storm Thorgerson, directed that video, and it went down the store in America. But the then record label just didn't follow it up in the way that they should have done, and it kind of died a death. And
And tell me what it's like when you walk into a music shop for the first time and you see your records. I mean, vinyl it would have been then, wouldn't it?
But
you see your records actually for sale with the name Big Country on the records, and you know, hang on a minute, that's us.
Well, that's really flattering. What's even weirder is walking into your friend's house and seeing your album in their record collection.
Or hearing it on the radio.
Or hearing on the radio. Say, well, thanks for paying my mortgage.
Did you get a real buzz? Get a buzz even now?
It's almost like an embarrassing buzz now, because I just think, you know, how we were a very effectual band. We affected people very deeply. We still do. I mean, the way that people relate to the band and the music, it's almost embarrassing, a tinge of embarrassment, because we're not there. I'm not there anymore. At the time, it was all part of it, and you know, and eyes were wide open and glowing. But now it's become this kind of folklore thing. I'm kind of thinking, oh, great, thanks.
But you did. You also collaborated on one or two of your records, and there's somebody else who's now living down here in the southwest.
Do you know what? I've been meaning to be able to contact her. Quick story. We decided to have some backing vocals on a track called The Seer, and we all decided unanimously we must try and get Kate Bush.
Who was, how old at that time? 13, 14?
I can't remember.
Very, very young,
very
wasn't she?
Young, very young. No, she'd be older than that. No, she'd had a few hits by then, you know, and we were all big fans. But we thought, you know, wish list, who would we like? Kate Bush. All of a sudden, somebody got in touch with her from the record company and thought, and then she said yes, she'd come down to the studio. So we were like four little boys, you know, tripping over each other to make tea for her and everything like that. And to be able to stand in a recording studio and listen to her just perform was, I think, the biggest buzz I've ever had, because she was a consummate professional. She had an unbelievable voice. And, you know, she seemed to enjoy herself. And, well, we were so chuffed to have her on the thing. And I've never been able to sort of see her again and thank her personally. And I will say that her new album, contrary to what everybody says, is absolute genius.
And she's living down here. I think she's South Devon now, isn't she?
Yes, well, I hope she enjoys living down here as much as I enjoy living in Cornwall.
Well, let's talk about you and living down here in just a moment or two, but I'm going to take you back in time. I hope I can give you that same buzz, because I've got The Seer lined up next. So here's Tony with Big Country and Kate Bush and a record called The Seer. That's Big Country and the unmistakable vocals of Kate Bush. You're listening to John Govia's Late Night Radio Show across the southwest on BBC Radio's Devon, Cornwall, Jersey and Guernsey, and across the world on the internet at bbc.co.uk/Devon, Cornwall, Jersey or Guernsey. It's 28 minutes before 11 o'clock. My guest this evening is from Big Country. It's bass player extraordinaire, Tony Butler, and now resident of the southwest as well. What brought you down to this neck of the woods then, Tony?
So I just got to sweep myself up off the
floor. Yeah, you enjoyed that, didn't you?
Oh, God, I haven't heard that for ages. It's brilliant. She's a star, stunning. What brought me to Cornwall? My wife was born in Foy, and when the band were kind of at its height, we were living up country. We wanted to live somewhere that was nice, you know, somewhere we can bring up our kids and in a nice community. And we found this gorgeous property in just outside Launceston, a little village called Altenan. And that's it. Decided to put roots down here and been here since 1987.
How did you get on being a black man in the southwest?
It really wasn't an issue. Maybe it's because I came down with this sort of the baggage of being in the pop business, and the people of Altenham at the time were fantastic. It was never an issue. I think I only had the police camp outside my house once just to make sure I was kosher. But that was fine. But no, it was never been a problem. My only problem was maybe people expected stuff from me because I was, you know, a star in inverted commas. And it's then I decided I wasn't going to play that game. I wouldn't do that anyway. But what I wanted to do is, if I was going to help people, I wanted to do it in a way that was real. So I decided to start up this little enterprise called Great West Records, which gave me an opportunity to get involved with people on a real basis, and they can actually learn something, learn the ropes of the music business, you know, learn how to make records, learn how to design sleeves, learn how to, you know, what record shops do and how much record shops make, you know.
So is your biggest love people or music industry?
People. Absolutely. I mean, I love the fact that I grew up from sort of endeavouring to try and make it in this business, and I was extremely lucky because apart from Big Country, I had some great breaks. I mean, I got to work on 3 Pete Townshend albums. Not many people can do that. And I was just so chuffed that I've had those opportunities. I played on the Pretender single. Chrissie Hynde was the love of my life at one stage. To make a record with them was fantastic.
Do you ever lay awake at night sometimes thinking, oh, if I look back at my life?
Well, if I do that, I'll never sleep. But but no, I'm really pleased and proud of the things I've done, the people I've made music with and people I've worked with. You know, they've helped me design my philosophy about what I do, but my main philosophy was always about enjoying what you do, but don't make other people suffer on the back of it, which, you know, we used to spend hours signing autographs. I don't want people to come to the show thinking we were untouchable and running away. You know, we'd stand there and sign autographs. You know, we were playing in Londonderry or Belfast a few years ago, and we spent 2.5 hours playing and then another 3 hours outside signing autographs. Why? Because we feel for the people. You know, they're not going to get to see us again. We love meeting them. And that was our philosophy as a band.
And they're the people buying your records.
And they're the people buying the records. So why not put yourself out to entertain these people, you know, on and off stage? It was part of the deal.
So how do you think, not the music, but the mechanics of the music industry has changed in the last 25 years, 20, 25 years?
Well, it's moved away from being something that's achievement by merit. You know, you write a good song, it becomes popular, it becomes successful. It's become, you know, a very sort of mechanical industry run by people, you know, in suits and accountants and whatever. And, you know, there is a new market that it has to appeal to.
So have you no time for things like Pop Idol and X Factor then, or
do you think
it's got a place?
I think it's got a place because people watch it. You know, people find entertainment from it. It's maybe not one's cup of tea, but, you know, I think it's got a place. I would never deny anybody any kind of entertainment. I mean, I've watched X Factor myself this time because I'm quite intrigued by this phenomenon called Chris Moyles, who's apparently the saviour of Radio 1. And
never heard of him.
No, not many people have. And I wanted to see how he would fare in that sort of situation, knowing the kind of guy he was. And X Factor attracted me for that particular reason. As a concept, I've got no time for it because it's not real. It's very plastic. And the people with real talent, people who we see, people who I see at colleges, people who I see who send me demos and stuff like that, the real people who endeavour to try and achieve something through merit, don't get a look in. And unfortunately, that's just part of the way the business
goes. Hasn't it always been right time, right place, though?
Absolutely. And I think it always will be. But I think until, you know, the internet is supposed to have been given people an opportunity to expose themselves, but even that has become a kind of, I don't know, as a concept, people don't have time for it anymore. It's a great idea, but people just don't have the time. People can't be bothered. You know, I've embraced the internet myself, you know, sort of pumping out my own sort of material in my own small way and having a MySpace site, blah, blah, blah. But the whole concept of having music free and available has become the norm. And to make money from music now is becoming almost impossible because people's concept of music is it's a free concept. You know, people expect to get things like music for nothing. So the people who depend on, you know, making money from music as a living, it's not happening just now.
So tell me a bit more about GWR Records then, because this is your sort of way of reaching out into the community in Cornwall, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in 97 I put it together to do it, to run it properly, to give songwriters and bands an opportunity to experience, you know, the ropes of being in the business, release a record into the community, try and get local radio stations, people like yourself, and you were very supportive at the time, and other people to get involved. And I found it was very difficult. I pumped a lot of money into it, and I didn't get much return, but I had a go. My biggest problems was getting money out of record shops, funny enough. They just wouldn't pay me back, and, you know, needed the cash flow.
There's a bit of a catch-22 situation, isn't there? When you play a record on the radio, you want it to be one that's well-known, well-liked already, mm-hmm. so that when people are listening to it, they go, oh, I like that one. And introducing new records sometimes, new songs to an audience
concept.
Is a tough, tough thing to do.
Exactly, because I don't think people don't have the patience now to sit down and adjudicate or analyse whether something's good or not by something new. people are force-fed stuff from by the larger record companies, and they have the wherewithal to do that. So they expect to be given stuff that they'll like immediately, not something that they can chew over and make their own minds up about. So, you know, new bands will always miss out on that level.
Mm.
Apart from people like yourself who will play new stuff late at night, and people who are interested will cotton on, and then they'll go and listen to the band's websites and MySpace and all that kind of stuff, and then they've got to get out and do the gigs themselves. So it's just, nothing's changed, really. It's just a more of a technological concept.
I want to talk a little bit more about you and your music, but first off, well, let's stay with the sort of community music, and apparently the World Cup is almost upon us.
Yes,
big thing called the Football World Cup or something, and you've been helping out, funnily enough, in a Cornish pub.
Well, I like beer, and people in my pub, where I think they love football, and 4 years ago they made a record at the local college, at Launceston College, called Ingerland. And they had a modicum of success with it. And at this time, they said they wanted to do something a little bit more professional. Would I help? And because I work at Launceston College and I've been helping them sort of develop the studio so it's of a good standard, I thought it would be a great sort of community thing to do. So I'd written a song for the Scottish World Cup squad whenever they last nearly qualified. It didn't go anywhere, so I just had the song on the shelf, so I just jigged it up a bit. And then I said, well, look, you guys perform it. I'll make it, but you guys come in and perform it. And I think every songwriter would love, especially people who like football, would love to write a chant that people might actually sing on the terraces. I think that's the biggest pop accolade you could possibly get, to have something, you know, that kind of sound I know my wife hates, but to write a chant that people can sing on the terraces was a real ambition of mine, and to have people do it and the way that they've done it on this particular track, I think I've nearly got there, but I'd love to hear it out there in Germany.
Did you take the studio to the pub or the pub to the studio?
I took the pub to the studio, and I just got them in, and we did a We Are the World thing. I just got them in there, did all the kind of the chorusy chanting bits, but also they sing some of the main lines as well. So again, a We Are the World type thing, I got them all to sort of sing particular lines, and I put it together. There were some parts of the song that were a little bit too musical for them, so I got my youngest son Jake to sing one of the lines, and I did another one, and a fabulous female vocal. You hear the sound of what I call the sound of Britannia is another Launceston College student called Becca.
Should we have a listen?
Oh, please.
Come on, boys.
Come on, boys.
And yet another World Cup song, but this one from Tony Butler and the Boys and Girls of a Cornish Pub. Oh, settle down now, settle down. Come on, boys, last orders, please. Can you imagine just going to your local and ending up on a CD for the England Football Supporters World Cup song? So that's for charity, I believe, Tony, isn't it?
Yes, that's we're collecting, all the proceeds are going to the Cancer Research UK and the South West Hospice.
Good charities, hospice, yeah, good charities, especially, yeah, well done that. So it's Harvey's Bar.
Yes.
The people, the customers of.
Yeah, customers Harvey's Bar. If you want to purchase this record, it's www.harveysbar.biz.
Priced at £3.50.
Yeah.
There you go. How about your own music then? Because that's you getting involved with lots of other people. And I have to say that I've actually got involved singing with Tony at one stage as well, because we did a charity record on for the BBC for Music Live back in 2000. And I just happened to have left that song at home on the shelf, unfortunately.
Oh, what a shame. I thought my
part was very good, but I'm not sure about the others, to be honest. But what about your own music, Tony? Because
my music is something that's will just go on and on. I mean, I write songs all the time. Ever since being in Big Country, one of the things that I did personally, and I have to, you know, Stuart was a great incentive, because he was a songwriting beast. And when we wrote songs, you know, we spent a lot of time writing songs together, just the two of us. And I started writing a lot of stuff, and, you know, he would sort of comment on stuff that I did. And, you know, it's a shame that he wasn't around long enough for us to be able to work on any more songs. But I decided to carry on. And unfortunately, between sort of 1999 and 2003, it was a pretty rough time for me because, I lost my mother-in-law, lost my mother, and lost Stuart. So my songwriting was going to reflect that. And this particular album is something I did. It's the first time I've ever written a selfish album. It's an opportunity that I didn't think I could sort of miss. I had to write songs which, just got things out of my system that I needed to get out. And, I was a little bit unsure whether I needed to share this sort of stuff. But I think as a songwriter, I needed to get through it in order to grow. And I felt it was a very selfish thing to do. I've recorded the whole thing practically on my own. I found it very difficult to try to introduce people, but a few people did come and work on some of the material. I have to thank Rob Strike, who's the head of music at Launceston College, who played some cellos and some stuff, which was fantastic, and Tom Norden, who's my colleague over at North Devon College. But they're the only people I could feel comfortable bringing in to do this, so everything else is done by me.
And the CD's called Life Goes On, which basically says it all.
Yes. Yeah, I think... I think this word cathartic would come up in this sort of conversation. I needed to try and find a way to look at a positive future. And I was looking at a future that didn't have anything to do with what I did before. Because when Stuart passed away, the big country finished for me. There was no way I was going to go and do that Queen thing and reform the band. It just felt wrong to do that because the band was so unique. My colleagues, Bruce and Mark, fortunately kind of felt the same way. But I just knew that I couldn't do it. And so in order to find a way through, I needed to do this album. And I needed to find a way of making life go on. And there's one track which, if people want to buy the album, brilliant, they'll find it. It's called Radical Measures. And it's me kind of doing a plastic surgery on myself, completely changing myself. Going to the... people decide to disfigure themselves and have plastic surgery to change their features. Well, I kind of decided to do this kind of emotionally and mentally, and then have this new image of myself, which has kind of come into fruition as me being a teacher, which was extraordinary. And I felt as though that I found something new and positive to do, especially something I could utilize my 20 years of experience in the music business with. And this album kind of goes through all those little bits of all those changes. There's some songs about my wife, there's songs about my mother, there's songs about my my mother-in-law, and I think the track you're going to play is basically about a conversation myself and Stuart had maybe just before we decided to stop Big Country. I think we got to that point where we decided we need to stop this because it needs to rejuvenate itself, it needs to refresh itself. More importantly, Stuart needed to repair himself. And I kind of said, look, Stuart, I think I'm going to leave the band for no other reason, for you to stop, for you to get off the treadmill, sort yourself out, sort your problems out. And I thought for a while that may work, but after a year he was back on the road with some American guy doing some stuff, and it was all a big mistake. The idea was to continue Big Country at some stage, but it wasn't going to happen. But this particular conversation, which Dream Boy is about, sort of just... It was just both of us bearing ourselves, basically.
And Tony's my guest this evening. Tony's living in Launceston now. My birthday. Yeah, and teaching, huge part of your life now.
Yeah, thanks for my wife for suggesting I do that, because I ended up going down to Plymouth College of Further Education to do a teaching course, and I absolutely loved it, and it kind of opened my eyes to my brain, basically. It did work after all this time, and I actually ended up getting myself a teaching qualification, teaching degree, so I thought I wanted to use it properly, and I got some teaching experience in a facility in Camelford called Education Out of School. And it was there I kind of came face to face with students, and I set a task to write some lyrics, because kids still think, I'll never write a song that's successful or famous. And I set them a task, and this girl wrote this set of lyrics which are completely and utterly moving. Because of confidentiality, I can't really sort of say anything about it, but I thought I'm going to put this song on my album, but I need just to change the context around in order to make...
It was an autobiographical song for her, then.
Yes, and it was very, very kind of close to the knuckle. And so I changed the concept and swizzled the lyrics a little bit, and it's now Not Supposed to Love You. And it's one of my favourite songs on this album, Life Goes On. And, you know, for those of you who've got it or will buy it, I think you will appreciate why I've got so attached to that particular song.
Tell me, with teaching, because you teach one day a week at Lonson College,
yeah,
and 4 days
at North Devon College.
North Devon College. Do your students come in and say, "Yeah, our teacher, he used to be in Big Country"? Do you know that? Or is it, I mean, a generation gap now?
It's more like, my mum remembers
you. my mum used to fancy you.
My dad saw you at the Colston Hall in Bristol in 1984. Now, I get a lot of that, and, you know, I accept that. That's going to happen. But my students get used to me, you know, and I get used to them. And they appreciate that I've got some background. And I really think that I can give them a lot of encouragement, experience, and help them sort of fulfill their dreams if they have any in my chosen field. And at Launceston College, you know, I'm helping at A level. And funnily enough, one of my students in my class is my youngest son, Jake.
So you're teaching your son A level
music technology. There is a distinction. And
okay,
we had to sort of tell the students, look, he's my son, I'm his dad, but in class we are just teacher and student. Yeah.
Tony, it's been a pleasure having you on the programme, as I knew it would be. Just remind people of your website address in case they'd like to find out more about you.
Yeah, if you want to come and see what I do or buy my album, it's www.tonybutlermusic.co.uk. All one word, tonybutlermusic.co.uk.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for giving me the airtime, John, and it's lovely to see you. You've got a lovely tan, nice short hair, and a lovely blue rugby shirt on.
Oh, no, you're talking now about my email from earlier.
Yes.
On, aren't you? You're dropping me in it. Who was that? Let me just find this one. Here we go. This comes from Natalie in Buckfastley. Hi, John. I have a mental picture of you. I just wonder if it matches your true description. I imagine you to be tall, butch,